for some of his big mistakes. The bell rang, and for the first time in my 3.5 years of teaching, I saw high school students so immersed they had to be urged out of the room by friends hungry for lunch. "Yo, Lenny, come on, finish it in the cafeteria." Next day, everyone had excuse notes, not only from Adam and Eve, but from God and Lucifer, some compassionate, some nasty. On behalf of Eve, Lisa Quinn defended her seduction of Adam on the grounds that she was tired of lying around paradise doing nothing day in, day out. She was also tired of God sticking his nose into their business and never allowing them a moment of privacy. It was all right for him. He could go off and hide behind a cloud somewhere and roar from time to time if he saw her or Adam go near his precious apple tree. There are heated discussions about the relative guilt and sinfulness of Adam and Eve. It is agreed unanimously that Lucifer the snake is a bastard, the son of a bitch and no good. No one is so brave as to say anything negative about God, although there are hints and suggestions he could have been a little more understanding of the plight of the first man and the first woman. Mikey Dolan says, "You could never talk like this in Catholic schools. Jesus, sorry, the nuns would pull you out of your seat by the ears and have your parents in to explain where you got ideas that were pure blasphemy." Other boys in the class, non-Catholics, bragged they'd never put up with that bullshit. They'd knock the nuns on their ass, and how come all them Catholic boys were such sissies? The discussion was drifting, and I worried that details might get back to Catholic parents who would object to a mention of nuns being treated roughly. I asked them to think about anyone in the world, at present or in history, who could use a good excuse note. I wrote suggestions on the blackboard. Eva Braun, Hitler's girlfriend. I asked, "How about Hitler himself?" Never. No excuses there. But maybe he had a miserable childhood. They wouldn't agree. An excuse note for Hitler might be a great challenge for a writer, but the excuse would never come from this class. On the board, Julius and Ethel Rosenberg, executed in 1953 for treason. How about excuse notes for draft dodgers? "Oh yeah, Mr. McCourt, these guys have big excuse notes. They don't want to fight for the country, but that's not us." On the board, Judas, Attila the Hun, Lee Harvey Oswald, Al Capone, all the politicians in America. "Yo, Mr. McCourt, you could put teachers up there. Not you, but all these pain-in-the-ass teachers that be giving us tests every other day." "Oh, I couldn't do that. They're my colleagues." "Okay, okay. We can write excuse notes for them explaining why they have to be like that." "Mr. McCourt, the principal is at the door." My heart sinks. Into the room the principal escorts the Staten Island superintendent of schools, Mr. Martin Wolfson. They don't acknowledge my existence. They don't apologize for interrupting the class. They walk up and down the aisles, peering at student papers. They pick them up for a closer look. Superintendent shows one to the principal. Superintendent frowns and purses his lips. Principal purses his lips. Class understands these are significant and important people. To show loyalty and solidarity, they refrain from asking for the pass. On their way out, the principal frowns at me and whispers that the superintendent would like to see me next period, even if they have to send someone to cover my class. I know, I've done something wrong again. The shit will hit the fan, and I don't know why. There will be a negative letter in my file. You do your best, you take the ball on the hop, you try something that has never ever been done in the whole history of the world. You have your kids hopping with enthusiasm over the excuse notes, but now comes the reckoning, teacher man, down the hallway to the principal's office. He's sitting at his desk. The way the superintendent stands still in the middle of the room reminds me of a repentant high school kid. Mr. McCourt. Come in. Only a minute. I just want to tell you that lesson, that project, whatever the hell you were doing in there was top-notch. That young man is what we need, that kind of down-to-earth teaching. Those kids were writing on a college level. He turns to the principal and says, That kid writing an excuse note for Judas. Brilliant, but I have a reservation or two. I'm not sure if the writing of excuse notes for evil or criminal people is justifiable or wise, though on second thoughts, it's what lawyers do, isn't it? And from what I've seen in your class, you might have some promising future attorneys in there, so I just wanted to shake your hand and tell you don't be surprised if there's a letter in your file attesting to your energetic and imaginative teaching. Thank you, and maybe you should divert them to more remote figures in history. An excuse now for Al Capone is a little risky. Thank you again. God in heaven, high praise from the superintendent of schools in Staten Island. Shall I dance down the hallway, or shall I lift and fly? Will the world object if I sing? I sing. Next day, I tell the class I know a song they'll like. A tongue twister of a song, and here it is. Oh, row the rattling bog, the bog down in the valley, oh. Oh, row the rattling bog, the bog down in the valley, oh. In that bog that was a tree, a rare tree, a rattling tree in the bog down in the valley, oh. We sang verse after verse, and they laughed as they tried to get their tongues around the words. Wasn't it great to see that teacher up there singing? Man, school should be like this every day, us writing excuse notes and teachers singing all of a sudden for some reason. The reason was I realized there was enough material in human history for millions of excuse notes. Sooner or later, everyone needs an excuse. Also, if we sang today, we could sing tomorrow, and why not? You don't need an excuse for singing. Augie was a nuisance in class, talking back, bothering the girls. I called his mother. Next day, the door is thrown open and a man in a black T-shirt with the muscles of a weightlifter yells,
Hey, Augie, come here.
You can hear Augie gasp.
Talking to you, Augie. I have to go in there. You're going to wish you was dead. Come here.
Augie yelped,
I didn't do nothing.
The man lumbers into the room, down the aisle to Augie's seat, lifts Augie into the air, carries him over to the wall, bangs him repeatedly against the wall.
I told you, bang, never, bang, never give your teacher, bang, no trouble, bang. I hear you give your teacher trouble, bang. I'm going to tear your goddamn head off, bang, and stick it up your ass, bang. You hear me, bang.
Hey, hold on. This is my classroom. I am the teacher. I can't have the world barging in here like this. I'm supposed to be in charge. Excuse me. The man ignores me. He's busy banging his son so hard against the wall that Augie hangs limp in his hands. I have to show who's in charge in this classroom. People can't just walk in here and reduce their sons to jelly. I repeat, excuse me. The man drags Augie back to his seat and turns to me.
He gives you trouble again, mister. I kick his ass here to New Jersey. He was brought up to give respect.
He turns to the class.
This teacher here, to learn yous kids. Yous don't listen to teacher, yous don't graduate. Yous don't graduate, yous wind up in the piers in some dead-end job. Yous don't listen to this teacher, yous doing yourself no favor. Understand what I'm telling yous?
They say nothing.
You understand what I'm telling yous? Yous a bunch of dummies. Is there some tough guy here wants to say something?
They say they understand, and all the tough guys are silent.
Okay, teacher, you can go back to work now.
On the way out, he slams the door so hard, chalk dust slides down the blackboard and windows rattle. There's a cold, hostile silence in the room that says, We know you called Augie's father. We don't like teachers who call people's fathers. No use saying, Oh, look. I didn't ask Augie's father to do that. I just spoke to his mother and thought they'd talk to him and tell him behave in class. It's too late. I've gone behind their backs, shown I can't handle the situation myself. There's no respect for teachers who send you to the office or call parents. If you can't handle it yourself, you shouldn't even be a teacher. You should get a job sweeping the streets or picking up the garbage. Sal Battaglia smiled every morning and said, Hi, Teach. Sal sat with his girlfriend Louise and looked happy. When they held hands across the aisle, everyone walked around them because it was understood this was the real thing. Someday Sal and Louise would be married, and that was sacred. Sal's Italian family and Louise's Irish family didn't approve, but at least the wedding would be Catholic, and that was okay. Sal joked to the class his family worried he might starve to death with an Irish wife, on account of how the Irish can't cook. He said his mother wondered how the Irish survived at all. Louise spoke up, said they could say what they liked, but the Irish had the most beautiful babies in the world. Sal blushed. Cool Italian, nearly 18, with a mass of black curly hair, actually blushed. Louise laughed, and we all laughed when she reached across the aisle to touch the redness of his face with her delicate white hand. The class went quiet when Sal took her hand and kept it against his face. You could see his eyes glistening with tears. What came over him? I stood with my back to the blackboard, not knowing what to say or do, not wanting to break the spell. At a time like this, how could I go on with our discussion of the Scarlet Letter? I went behind my desk, pretended to be busy, silently took the attendance again, filled out a form, waited for the bell to ring in 10 minutes, watched Sal and Louise leave, hand in hand, and envied them the way everything was laid out. After graduation, there would be an engagement. Sal would become a master plumber, Louise, a legal stenographer, the highest you can go in the secretarial world unless you got the crazy notion to become a lawyer. I told Louise she was bright enough to be anything, but she said, no, no. What would her family say? She had to earn a living, get ready for her life with Sal. She'd learn Italian cooking so she wouldn't be beholden all the time to Sal's mother. A year after the wedding, a baby would appear, a little round, well-fed, Italian-Irish-American baby, and that would bring the two families together forever. And who cared what countries their parents came from? None of that happened because of an Irish kid who went after Sal in a Prospect Park gang rumble and clobbered him with a 2x4. Sal didn't even belong to a gang. He was just passing through, delivering an order from the restaurant where he worked nights and weekends. He and Louise knew these gang wars were stupid, especially with the Irish and Italians who were all Catholic and white. So why? What was it all about? Something called turf, territory. Even worse, girls. Hey, get your guinea hands off my girl. Get your fat mick ass out of our neighborhood. Sal and Louise could understand rumbling with the Puerto Ricans or the Negroes, but not one another, for Christ's sakes. Sal returned wearing a bandage to cover his stitches. He swung over to the right side of the room, well away from Louise. He ignored the class and no one looked at him or spoke to him. Louise took her old seat, tried to catch his eye. She turned towards me as if I had answers or could fix things. I felt inadequate and indecisive. Should I go back there, squeeze her shoulder, whisper encouraging words about how Sal would get over this? Should I go to Sal, apologize for the Irish race, tell him you can't judge a whole people by the actions of one lout in Prospect Park, remind him Louise was still lovely, still loved him? How are you supposed to discuss the conclusion of the Scarlet Letter, the happy end for Hester and Pearl, with Louise sitting a few rows back, her heart broken, Sal staring straight ahead, ready to murder the first Irishman to cross his path? Ray Brown raised his hand. Good old Ray, always stirring the pot. Hey, Mr. McCourt, how come no Negroes in this book? I must have looked blank. Everyone but Louise and Sal laughed. I don't know, Ray. I don't think they had Negroes in all New England. Sal jumped from his seat. Yeah, they had Negroes, Ray, but the Irish killed them all, snuck up behind them and busted their heads. Oh, yeah? Said Ray. Yeah, said Sal. He picked up his bag, walked out, made his way to the guidance office. The counselor told me Sal asked for a transfer to Mr. Campbell's class, who at least wasn't Irish and didn't have that stupid accent. You could never imagine Mr. Campbell hitting you from behind with a 2x4, but that McCourt, he's Irish, and you can never trust these sneaky bastards. I did not know what to do about Sal. It was 3 months to graduation, and I should have tried to talk to him, but I was unsure of what to say. In the school hallways, I often saw teachers comforting kids, arm around the shoulder, Warm hug. Don't worry. Everything will be okay. Boy or girl saying, thank you. Tears. Teacher squeezing shoulder one last time. That's what I wanted to do. Should I have told Sal I was not a 2x4 wielding lout? Should I have insisted on telling him how unfair it was to make Louise suffer for the actions of someone who was probably drunk? Oh, you know how the Irish are, Sal. And he would have laughed and said, okay, Irish have that problem, and made up with Louise. Or should I have talked to Louise, trotted out a few platitudes like, oh, you'll get over it in time, or there's more than one fish in the ocean, or you won't be single long, Louise. Boys are going to be knocking on your door. I knew if I tried to talk to either one, I would have fumbled and stammered. The best thing was to do nothing, which is all I was capable of anyway. Some day I'd comfort someone in the hall with the strong arm there on the shoulder, the soft word, the hug. Teachers refuse to have Kevin Dunn in their classes. The kid is just a royal pain in the ass, troublemaker, out of control. If the principal insists on sticking him in their classes, they'll throw in their papers, demand their pensions, walk out. That kid belongs in a zoo, monkey section, not a school. So they sent him to the new teacher, the one who cannot say no, me. Also, you can see with that red hair, freckles all over, that name, the kid is Irish. Surely an Irish teacher with a genuine bro can handle the little bastard. Guidance counselor says he's counting on something, you know, atavistic, something that might strike a chord. A real Irish teacher could surely stir something ethnic in Kevin's genes, right? Guidance counselor says Kevin is going on 19 and should be graduating this year, but after being kept back 2 years, there's no chance he'll ever wear cap and gown. No chance at all. The school is playing a waiting game, hoping he'll drop out, join the army or something. They'll take anyone in the army these days, the lame, the halt, the blind, the Kevins of the world. They say, he'll never make it to my classroom alone, so would I please pick him up at the guidance office? He sits in an office corner, lost in a parka too big for him, his face deep in the hood. The guidance counselor says, here he is, Kevin. Here's your new teacher. Pull your hood down so he can see you. Kevin doesn't move. Oh, come on, Kevin. Drop the hood. Kevin shakes his head. The head moves, but the hood stays in place. Okay, you go with Mr. McCourt and try to cooperate. Guidance counselor whispers, he might, you know, identify with you a little. He identifies with nothing. He sits at his desk, drumming with his fingers, hidden inside his hood. The principal on his rounds sticks his head in the door and tells him, son, take off that hood. Kevin ignores him. The principal turns to me. We having a little discipline problem here? That's Kevin Dunn. Oh. And he backs out. I feel trapped in some kind of mystery. When I mention him to other teachers, they roll their eyes and tell me new teachers are often stuck with the impossible cases. The guidance counselor tells me, don't worry about it, Kevin is trouble, but he's dysfunctional and won't be around long. Just be patient. Next day, just before noon, he asks for the pass. He says, how come you give me the pass just like that? How come? You want to get rid of me, right? You said you wanted the pass. Here it is. Go. Why are you telling me go? It's just an expression. That's not fair. I didn't do nothing wrong. I don't like people saying go like it was some kind of a dog. I wish I could take him aside for a talk, but I know I'm no good at that. It's easier to talk to the whole class than to one boy. It isn't so intimate. He disrupts the class with irrelevant remarks. English has more dirty words than any other language. If you wear your right shoe on your left foot and your left shoe on your right foot, it'll make your brain more powerful and all your children will be twins. God has a pen that never needs ink. Babies know everything when they're born. That's why they can't talk, because if they talked, we'd all be stupid. He says beans make you fart, and it's a good thing to feed them to small children because the bean growers train dogs to track down the small children in case they're lost or kidnapped. He knows for a fact that rich families feed their children a lot of beans because rich children were always in fear of being kidnapped. And when he got out of high school, he was going into business training dogs who would find the little rich bean-eating children through their farts. And he'd be in all the newspapers and all over TV. And could he now have the pass? His mother visits on open school day. She can do nothing with him, doesn't know what's wrong with him. His father ran off when Kevin was 4, the bastard, and now lives in Scranton, Pennsylvania, with a woman who raises white mice for experiments. Kevin loves the white mice, but hates his stepmother for selling them to people who stick things in them or cut them open just to see if they lost or gain weight. When he was 10, he threatened to go after the stepmother and the police had to be called. Now his mother wonders how he's doing in my class. Is he learning anything? Do I require homework? Because he never brings home book, notebook, or pencil. I tell her he's a bright boy with a lively imagination. She says, yeah, that's fine for you, having a bright boy in class, but what about his future? She's worried he'll drift into the army and wind up in Vietnam, where he'll stand out with his mop of red hair and be a moving target for the gooks. I tell her I didn't think they'd take him in the army, and she looks offended. She says, what do you mean? He's as good as any kid in the school. His father had a year of college, you know, and he used to read newspapers. I mean, I don't think he's the military type. My Kevin can do anything. My Kevin is as good as any kid in the school, and if I was you, I wouldn't underestimate him. I try to talk to him, but he ignores me or pretends not to hear. I sent him to the guidance counselor, who returns him with a note suggesting I keep him busy. Make him wash the blackboards. Send him to the basement to clean the erasers. Maybe, says the guidance counselor, he could fly into space with an ex-astronaut and just keep orbiting. That's a guidance joke. I tell Kevin I'm making him classroom manager in charge of everything. He finishes his chores in a few minutes and tells the class to observe how fast he is. Danny Guarino says he's faster at everything every time, and he'll see Kevin outside after school. I separate them and make them promise they won't fight. Kevin asks for the pass, then refuses it, saying he isn't a baby like some people in the room who have to go every few minutes. His mother adores him. Other teachers won't have him. The guidance counselor passes the buck, and I do not know what to do with him. In the closet, he finds hundreds of little watercolor jars with contents dried and cracked. He says, wah, wah, oh man, jars, jars, colors, colors, mine, mine. Okay, Kevin, would you like to clean them? You could stay right here by the sink with this special table, and you don't have to sit at your desk anymore. It's a risk. He might take offense at being offered a task of pure drudgery. Yeah, yeah, my jars, my table, gonna take off my hood. He pushes back the hood, and the hair flames. I tell him, I have never seen such red hair, and he grins. He works at the sink for hours, spooning out the old paste into a large pickle jar, scrubbing the caps, arranging the jars on the shelves. At the end of the year, he's still working, still not finished. I tell him he won't be up to stay during the summer, and he cries out of frustration. Could he take the jars home? His cheeks are wet. All right, Kevin, take them home. He touches my shoulder with his multicolored hand, tells me I'm the greatest teacher in the world, and if anyone ever gives me trouble, he'll take care of them because he has ways of dealing with people who bother teachers. He takes home dozens of glass jars. He does not return in September. Guidance people at the Board of Education sent him to a special school for incorrigibles. He runs away and lives a while with the white mice in his father's garage. Then the army takes him, and his mother comes to the school to tell me he's missing in Vietnam, and she shows me a picture from his room. On the table, the glass jars are arranged in a series of letters that say, McCourt, OK. See, his mother says, he liked you for helping him, but the communists got him, so tell me, what was the use? Look at all the moms have kids blown to bits. Jesus, you don't even have a finger to bury. And will you tell me what's going on in that country over there nobody ever heard of? Will you tell me that one war finishes, another one starts, and you're lucky if you just have daughters won't be sent over there? From a canvas bag, she pulls a large pickle jar filled with Kevin's dried paints. She says, look at that. Every color in the rainbow in that jar, and you know what? He cut off all his hair, and you can see where he mixed it in with those paints. That's a work of art, right? And I know he'd want you to have it. I could have been honest with Kevin's mother, told her I did little for our son. He seemed like a lost soul, floating around looking for a place to drop anchor. But I didn't know enough, or I was too shy to show affection. I kept the jar on my desk, where it glowed incandescent, and when I looked at clumps of Kevin's hair, I felt sorry over the way I let him drift out of the school and off to Vietnam. My students, especially the girls, said the jar was beautiful. Yeah, a work of art. And it must have taken a lot of work. I told them about Kevin, and some of the girls cried. A maintenance man cleaning the classroom thought the jar was junk and took it away to the trash in the basement. I talked to teachers in the cafeteria about Kevin. They shook their heads. They said, too bad. Some of these kids slip through the cracks, but what the hell is the teacher supposed to do? We have huge classes, no time. And we're not psychologists. At 30, I married Alberta Small and started courses at Brooklyn College for the Master of Arts in English Literature, a degree that would help me rise in the world, earn respect, increase my teacher's salary. To fulfill the requirements for the degree, I wrote a thesis on Oliver St. John Gogarty, doctor, poet, playwright, novelist, wit, athlete, champion drinker at Oxford, memoirist, senator, friend briefly of James Joyce, who turned him into the Buck Mulligan of Ulysses and made him famous worldwide and forever. My thesis title was Oliver St. John Gogarty, A Critical Study. There was nothing critical about the thesis. I chose Gogarty because of my admiration for him. If I read him and wrote about him, some of his charm, talent, and learning would surely rub off on me. I might develop some of his dash and flair, his flamboyant air. He was a Dublin character, and I hoped I might become a debonair, hard-drinking, poetic Irishman like him. I'd be a New York character. I'd set the table on a roar and dominate the bars of Greenwich Village with song and story. At the Lion's Head Bar, I drank whiskey after whiskey to give myself the courage to be colourful. Bartenders suggested I slow down. Friends say they didn't understand the word coming out of my mouth. They lifted me out of the bar and into a taxi, paid the driver, and told him to drive non-stop till I reached my door in Brooklyn. I tried to be Gogarty witty with Alberta, but she told me, for God's sake, be quiet. And all I got from my efforts to be Gogartian was a hangover so agonizing I fell to my knees and asked God to take me. Professor Julian Kay accepted my thesis despite a repetitiousness of style and a solemnity which conflicts with the subject, Gogarty. My first and favorite professor at Brooklyn College was Martin Irving Sydon, Yeats scholar. He wore a bow tie. He could lecture 3 hours on the Anglo-Saxon Chronicles or Chaucer or Matthew Arnold, the material perfectly organized in his head. He was there to lecture, pour knowledge into empty vessels, and if you had any questions, you could see him in his office. He would not waste class time. He had written his doctoral dissertation at Columbia University on Yeats and a book, Paradox of Hate, in which he argued that fear of Jewish sexuality was a major cause of anti-Semitism in Germany. I took his year-long course on the history of English literature, from Beowulf to Virginia Woolf, from warrior to warrior. You could see he wanted us to know and understand how English literature had developed and the language along with it. He insisted we should know the literature the way a doctor knows the body. Everything he said was news to me, one of the benefits of being innocent and ill-educated. I knew bits and pieces of English literature, but it was thrilling with Sidon, rolling along from writer to writer, from century to century, pausing for a closer look at Chaucer, John Skelton, Christopher Marlowe, John Dryden, the Enlightenment, the Romantics, the Victorians, and on into the 20th century with Sidon reading passages to illustrate the development of English from Anglo-Saxon through Middle English through Modern English. After those lectures, I felt sorry for people on subway trains who didn't know what I knew, and I was eager to get back to my own classroom and tell my students how the English language had changed down the centuries. I tried to prove it by reading passages from Beowulf, but they said, "Nah, that ain't English. You think we're stupid?" I tried to imitate Sidon's elegant style with my classes of plumbers, electricians, auto mechanics, but they looked at me as if I had lost my wits. Professors could get up there and lecture to their heart's content with never a fear of contradiction or a quibble. That was a life to be envied. They never had to tell anyone, "Sit down, open your notebooks, no, you may not have the pass." They never had to break up fights. Assignments were to be completed on time. No excuses, sir or madam. This is not high school. If you find it difficult to keep up with the work, you ought to drop the course. Excuses are for children. I envied Sidon and the college professors in general, their weekly 4 or 5 classes. I taught 25. They had complete authority. I had to earn it. I said to my wife, "Why should I have to struggle with moody teenagers when I could live the easy life of a college professor? Wouldn't it be a pleasure to stroll into the classroom in that casual way, nod to acknowledge their mere existence, deliver the lecture to the back wall or a tree outside the window, scratch a few illegible notes on the board, announce the next paper to be written, 700 words on money symbolism in Dickens' Bleak House? No complaints, no challenges, no excuses." Alberta said, "Oh, stop the whining. Get off your ass and get a PhD, and you can be a nice little university professor. You can bullshit the female sophomores." When Alberta was taking the examination for the teacher's license, she met Arlene Dahlberg and brought her home for dinner. She kicked off her shoes and sat on the couch drinking wine and telling us about her life with her husband, Edward. They lived in Mallorca, but she returned to the States from time to time to teach and make money to keep them going in Spain. She said Edward was quite famous, and I said nothing, because I could remember coming across his name only once in an essay by Edmund Wilson on proletarian writers. Arlene said he'd be returning from Spain in a few months, and she'd invite us over for a drink. From the minute I met him, I didn't like Edward Dahlberg, or maybe I was nervous about meeting a man of letters, my introduction to the social world of American literature. The evening Alberta and I came over, he sat in a deep armchair in a corner by the window facing a semicircle of admirers. They talked about books. They asked his opinion about various writers. He waved his hand and, except for himself, dismissed everyone in the 20th century. Hemingway wrote Baby Talk, Faulkner Sludge, Joyce's Ulysses was a trudge through the ordure of Dublin. He demanded everyone go home and read authors I'd never heard of, Suetonius, Anaxagoras, Sir Thomas Browne, Eusebius, the Desert Fathers, Flavius Josephus, Randolph Byrne. Arlene introduced me. "This is Frank McCall from Ireland. He teaches high school English." I put out my hand, but he let it hang. "Oh, still a high school boy, are you?" I didn't know what to say. I wanted to punch the discourteous son of a bitch, but I did nothing. He laughed and said to Arlene, "Does our friend teach English to deaf mutes?" In the Dahlberg world, teaching was for women only. I backed away to my chair, confused. Dahlberg had a massive head with strands of gray hair pasted across the baldness. One eye was dead in its socket, and the other moved rapidly, doing the work of two. He had a strong nose and a luscious mustache, and when he smiled there was a flash of false white teeth which clacked. He wasn't finished. He turned the one eye on me. "Does our high school boy read? And what does he read?" I searched my head for something I'd read recently, something distinguished that might please him. I'm reading the autobiography of Sean O'Casey. He let me suffer a moment, passed his hand over his face, grunted, "Sean O'Casey, pray, quote me a line." My heart jumped and pounded. The semicircle of admirers waited. Dahlberg lifted his head as if to say, "Yes?" My mouth was dry. I could think of nothing from O'Casey that would match the grand passages Dahlberg quoted from the ancient masters. I mumbled, "Well, I admire O'Casey for the natural way he writes about his life growing up in Dublin." He let me suffer again while he smiled at his admirers. He nodded toward me. "The natural way he writes," says our Irish friend. If you admire so-called natural writing, you can always scrutinize the walls of a public lavatory. The admirers laughed. My face was hot, and I blurted, "O'Casey fought his way out of the slums of Dublin. He was half-blind. He's a champion of the worker. He's as good as you any time. The whole world knows Sean O'Casey. Who ever heard of you?" He shook his head for the benefit of his admirers, and they shook their heads in agreement. He called to Arlene, "Tell your high school boy to leave my presence. He's not welcome here, though his charming wife is welcome to stay." I followed Arlene to the bedroom to retrieve my coat. I told her I was sorry for causing trouble and despised myself for my apology, but she kept her head down and said nothing. In the living room, Dahlberg was pawing Alberta's shoulder, telling her he had no doubt she was a fine teacher and hoped she would visit again. In silence, we rode the subway to Brooklyn. I was confused and wondered why Dahlberg had to behave like that. Did he have to humiliate a stranger? And why did I put up with it? Because I didn't have the self-confidence of an eggshell. He was 60. I was 30. I was like someone arrived from a wild place. I'd never be at ease in literary circles. I was out of my depth and too ignorant to belong to that squad of admirers who could lob literary names at Dahlberg. I felt paralyzed and ashamed of myself and swore I'd never see that man again. I'd give up this dead-end teaching career that brought no respect, get a part-time job, spend my life reading in libraries, go to parties like this one, quote and recite, hold my own with the likes of Dahlberg and his adoring circle. Arlene invited us back, but now Dahlberg was polite, and I was wary and smart enough to defer to him, to fall into the role of acolyte. He asked me always what I was reading, and I kept the peace by trotting out the Greeks, the Romans, the Church Fathers, Miguel de Cervantes, Burton's Anatomy of Melancholy, Emerson, Thoreau, and of course, Edward Dahlberg, as if I were doing nothing now but sitting on my arse all day in a deep armchair, reading, reading, and waiting for Alberta to serve my dinner and massage my poor neck. If the conversation turned dark and dangerous, I'd quote from his books and watch his face brighten and soften. It surprised me that a man who dominated gatherings and made enemies everywhere could fall for flattery so easily. It surprised me also that I was clever enough to work out a strategy that would keep him from exploding in his chair. I was learning to bite my tongue and take his abuse because I thought I might profit from his learning and wisdom. I envied him for living the life of a writer, a dream I was too timid to chance. I admired him or anyone who went his own way and stuck to his guns. Even with all my various experiences in America, I still felt like someone just off the boat. When he moaned about the hard life of a writer, the daily suffering of man at desk, I wanted to say, "Oh, anguish my arse, Dahlberg. All you do is sit there tapping at your typewriter a few hours in the morning and reading the rest of the day while Arlene hovers, attending to your every need. You never did a hard day's work in your life. One day teaching 170 teenagers would send you running back to your soft literary life." I saw him occasionally till he died in California at 77. He'd invite me to dinner with instructions to bring my brack. The dictionary told me my brack was my bitch. I realized he was more interested in my brack than in me. And when he suggested that we all spend the summer together driving across country, I knew what he was up to, a fling along the way with Alberta. The clever man would contrive to send me on a futile errand while he and Coyle and slithered from his tree. He called one Saturday morning to invite us to dinner, and when I said we were busy that night, he said, "And what, my fine Irish friend, am I to do with the food I've purchased?" I said, "Eat it. That's all you ever do anymore, anyhow." It wasn't much of a rejoinder, but it was the last word. I never heard from him again. Every June, during my 8 years at McKee, the English department met in the classroom to read, evaluate, grade the New York State English Regents examination. Barely half the students at McKee passed the examination. The other half had to be helped. We tried to inflate the failure grades from high 50s to passing, the mandated 65. We could do nothing about multiple choice questions, the answers were right or wrong, but we helped with essays on literature and general topics. Give the kid credit for being there, sure, what the hell. He could be someplace else getting into trouble, bothering people. 3 points for showing up for selfless citizenship. Is his writing legible? Sure. Another 2 or 3 points. Did the kid ever bother teachers in class? Well, maybe on one occasion, yeah, but he was probably provoked. Besides, his father is dead, a dock worker who defied the mob and wound up in the Gowanus Canal for his troubles. Gave the kid another 2 points for having a dead father in the Gowanus. We're getting that grade up there, aren't we? Does the student use paragraphs? Oh, yeah. Look how he indents. The kid is a master of indentation. There are definitely 3 paragraphs here. Does he have topic sentences in his paragraph? Well, you know, you could argue that the first sentence is a topic sentence. Okay. Give him another 3 points for his topic sentences. So where are we now? 63? Is he a nice kid? Oh, sure. Helpful in class? Yeah. He cleaned erasers for his social studies teacher. Polite in the hallways? Always said good morning. Look at this. He gave his essay a title. My Country, Right or Wrong. Now, isn't that something? Pretty sophisticated, choosing an essay title. Couldn't we raise him 3 for choice of patriotic topic and 1 point for using a semicolon, even if the situation calls for a colon? Is that really a semicolon or is the paper a flyport? There are kids in the school who don't even know colons exist and don't care. And if you were to stand up there and tell them the differences between the colon and its cousin, the semicolon, they'd just ask for the pass. Why not raise him another 3 points? He's a nice kid, and his brother Stan is in Vietnam. His father got polio when he was a kid, spends his life in a wheelchair. Oh, give the boy another point for having a father in a wheelchair and a brother in Vietnam. So, he's up to 68. 68 is less likely to arouse suspicions in Albany, where they're supposed to be checking these tests. Unlikely they'll look at every exam with the thousands flowing in from around the state. Besides, if there are questions, we teachers will stand shoulder to shoulder to defend our marking system. Let's go to lunch. Mr. Biberstein, the guidance counselor, said if I had any trouble with any kid to let him know and he'd take care of it. He said new teachers in the system were treated like dirt or worse. You sink or swim. I never told him about any difficulties with students. The word gets out. Yeah, man, that new teacher McCourt, he'd send your ass to the guidance council, and the next thing, he's calling your dad, and you know what that means. Mr. Biberstein joked that I must be a great teacher, getting along so well with the kids, I never sent one to his office. He said it must be my Irish charm. You're not much to look at, but the girls love your accent. They told me, so don't waste it. When we went on strike with the new union, the United Federation of Teachers, Mr. Biberstein, Mr. Tolson, and Miss Gilfillan, the art teacher, crossed the picket line. We called to them, "Don't go in, don't go in." But they went in, Miss Gilfillan weeping. The teachers who crossed the picket line were older than the ones outside. They may have been members of the old teachers' union, which was crushed during the McCarthy witch hunt era. They did not want to be hounded again, even though we were striking mostly for recognition as a union. I felt sympathy for the older teachers, and when the strike was over, wanted to say I was sorry for the way we shouted at them. On our picket line, at least, no one called out "scab" the way they did in other schools. Still, there was tension and division at McKee High School, and I didn't know if I could be friends anymore with the people who crossed the line. Before I became a teacher, I hit the picket line with the Hotel Workers Union, the Teamsters, and the International Longshoremen's Association, and was fired from a bank merely for talking to a union organizer. There were warnings, and no one would dare to ignore them. "Cross this line, pal, and we know where you live. We know where your kids go to school." We could never say things like that from a teacher's picket line. We were professionals, teachers, college graduates. When the strike ended, we gave the scabs the cold shoulder in the teacher's cafeteria. They ate together on the other side of the room. In the while, they stopped coming to the cafeteria altogether, and we had the place to ourselves, loyal members of the United Federation of Teachers. Mr. Biberstein barely nodded to me in the hallways, and there were no more offers of help with difficult kids. I was surprised when he stopped me one day and barked, "What's this about Barbara Sadler?" "What do you mean?" "She came to my office and said you encouraged her to go to college."
"That's right."
"What do you mean, that's right?"
"I mean, I suggested she go to college." "I'd like to remind you, this is a vocational and technical high school, not a feeder school for colleges. These kids go into the trades, son. They're not ready for college." I told him Barbara Sadler was one of the brightest students in my 5 classes. She wrote well, read books, participated in class discussions, and if I myself, licensed teacher, could go to college without a scrap of high school education, why couldn't Barbara think of it? No one said she had to be a beautician, secretary, or anything else. "Because, young man, you're giving kids ideas they shouldn't have. We're trying to be realistic here, and you're coming in with your crazy half-assed ideas. I'm going to have to talk to her and set her straight. I'd appreciate it if you backed off. Teach English and leave guidance to me." He turned to walk away, but turned back again. "It wouldn't have anything to do with the fact that Barbara is a good-looking blonde, would it?" I wanted to say something mean. "Scab" jumped into my head, but I kept silent. He walked away from me, and that was the last time we ever spoke. Was it the strike, or was it really Barbara? He left a greeting card in my mailbox with a note. "A man's reach should exceed his grasp, but you better make sure they have something to grasp. Don't create impossible dreams. Regards, Fergus Biberstein."
Part 2. Donkey on a Thistle. In 1966, after 8 years at McKee, it was time to move on. I still struggled to hold the attention of 5 classes every day, though I was learning what was obvious. You have to make your own way in the classroom. You have to find yourself. You have to develop your own style, your own techniques. You have to tell the truth, or you'll be found out. "Oh, teacher man, that's not what you said last week." It isn't a matter of virtue or high morality. So, goodbye, McKee Vocational and Technical High School. With my new master's degree, I'm off to New York Community College in Brooklyn, where a friend, Professor Herbert Miller, helped me find a position as adjunct lecturer, the lowest level of teacher in the university system. I'll have 5 or 6 classes every week, not every day. I'll be in heaven with all that free time. I'll earn half the salary of the high school teacher, but the students will be mature. They'll listen and show respect. They won't throw things. They won't object and complain over work in class and homework assignments. Also, they'll call me professor, and that will make me feel important. I am to teach 2 courses, Introduction to Literature and Basic Composition. My students were adult, mostly under 30. working around the city in stores, factories, offices. There was a class of 33 firemen working for college credit to rise in the department, all white, mostly Irish. Almost everyone else was black or Hispanic. I could have been one of them, working by day, studying by night. Since there were no discipline problems, I had to adjust and develop a kind of teaching where I didn't have to tell anyone, "Sit down, please, and be quiet." If they were late, they said sorry and took their seats. I hardly knew what to do when this first class was filed in, sat, and waited for my lecture. No one asked for the lavatory pass. No one raised a hand to accuse anyone of stealing a sandwich or a book or a seat. No one tried to get me off the subject by asking me about Ireland in general, or my miserable childhood in particular. "You have to get up there, man, and teach." A footnote, ladies and gentlemen, is what you put at the bottom of the page to show the source of your information. A hand. "Yes, Mr. Fernandez?"
"How come?"
"How come what?"
"I mean, if I'm writing about the New York Giants, why can't I just say I read it in the Daily News? Why?"
"Because, Mr. Fernandez, this is a research paper, and that means you have to show exactly, Mr. Fernandez, where you got your information."
"I don't know, Professor. I mean, that seems like a lot of trouble. I'm just writing this paper about the Giants and why they're having a losing season. I mean, I'm not training to be a lawyer or nothing."
Mr. Tomas Fernandez was 29. He worked as a mechanic for New York City. He hoped an associate degree would help him get a promotion. He had a wife and three children, and sometimes in class he fell asleep. When he snored, the other students would look at me to see what I was going to do about it. I touched his shoulder and suggested he take a break outside. He said okay, left the room, and did not return that night. He missed class the following week, and when he returned said no, he wasn't sick. He was over in New Jersey at the football game, the Giants, you know. He had to see the Giants when they were at home. Couldn't miss his Giants. He said it was too bad this class was on Monday, same night as the game when the Giants were home.
"Too bad, Mr. Fernandez?"
"Yeah, like, you know, I can't be in two places at one time." "But, Mr. Fernandez, this is a college. This course is required."
"Yeah," says Mr. Fernandez. "I understand your problem, Professor."
"My problem? My problem, Mr. Fernandez?
Well, like, you have to do something about me and the Giants, right?"
"It's not that, Mr. Fernandez. It's just that if you don't attend class, you are going to fail." He stares at me as if trying to understand why I'm talking in this strange way. He tells me in the class how he's followed the Giants all his life, and he's not going to desert them now that they're having a losing season. No one will respect him. His seven-year-old son would despise him. Even his wife, who never cared about the Giants, would lose respect for him.
"Why, Mr. Fernandez?"
"That's easy to see, Professor. All these Sundays and Mondays I spent on the Giants, she waits home for me, takes care of the kids and everything, even forgives me the time of her mother's funeral when I couldn't go because the Giants were in the playoffs, man. So now, if I was to give up the Giants, she'd say, 'What was it all for, me waiting and waiting?' She'd say it was all wasted. That's how she'd lose respect, because there's one thing about my wife. She sticks to her guns the way I stick to the Giants. Know what I mean?" Rowena from Barbados says she thinks this discussion is a waste of class time, and why doesn't he grow up? Why didn't he take this class on another night besides Monday?
"Because the other classes were full. And I heard Mr. McCourt was a nice guy that wouldn't mind if I went to a football game after working all day, you know?"
Rowena from Barbados says she doesn't know.
"Shit or get off the pot, man. Excuse the language. We come here after a hard day's work, too, and we don't snore in class and run off to football games. We should have a vote."
Heads nod around the room. Yes to the vote. 33 say Mr. Fernandez should attend class. No Giants. Mr. Fernandez votes for himself. Giants all the way. Even though the Giants are on television that evening, he's gracious enough to stay till the end of the class. He shakes my hand and assures me he has no hard feelings, that I'm really a nice guy, but we all have our blind spots. Freddie Bell was an elegant young black man. He worked in the men's clothing department at the Abraham and Strauss department store. He helped me select a jacket there, and that led to a different level of relationship. Yes, I'm in your class, but I helped you pick out that jacket. He liked to write in a florid style using big words and rare words lifted from dictionary and thesaurus. And when I wrote on his paper, "Simplify, simplify, Thoreau," he wanted to know who was this Thoreau and why would anyone want to write like a baby. "Because, Freddie, your reader might appreciate clarity. Clarity, Freddie, clarity." He didn't agree. His high school English teacher told him the English language was a glorious organ. Why not take advantage of this tremendous instrument? Put out all the stops, so to speak. "Because, Freddie, what you're doing is false, forced, and artificial." That was the wrong thing to say, especially with 30 of his fellow students watching and listening. His face froze, and I knew I had lost him. That would mean a hostile presence in the class the remainder of the term, a discomforting prospect for me, still making my way in this adult student world. He struck back with language. His writing became more elaborate and tortured. His grades slipped from A's to B minuses. At the end, he asked for an explanation of the grade. He said he'd shown his essays to his old English teacher, and he, the old English teacher, simply could not understand how Freddie could get less than an A+. "Look at the language. Look at the vocabulary. Look at the levels of meaning. Look at the sentence structure. Varied, sophisticated, complex." We faced each other in the hallway. He would not give up. He said he worked hard in my class, looking up new words so that I wouldn't be bored with the same old words. His old English teacher said there was nothing worse than reading miles of student writing and never coming across an original thought or some fresh vocabulary. Old English teacher said Mr. McCourt should appreciate Freddie's efforts and reward him accordingly. Freddie should get credit simply for venturing into new territory, for pushing the envelope. "Also," said Freddie, "I work nights to make a living and pay my way through college. You know what that's like, Mr. McCourt?" "I don't see what that has to do with your writing. Also, it's not easy when you're black in this society." "Oh, Christ, Freddie. It's not easy being anything in this society. All right, you want an A, you'll get it. I don't want to be accused of bigotry." "No, I don't want it just because you're pissed off or because I'm black. I want it because I deserve it." I turned to walk away. He called after me. "Hey, Mr. McCourt, thanks. I like your class. It's weird, that class. But I figured I might even become a teacher like you." I'm teaching this course that requires a research paper. The students must demonstrate the ability to select a topic, engage in basic research, make notes on index cards so that the instructor can determine the source of the material, provide scholarly footnotes, and a bibliography of primary and secondary sources. I take my students to the library so that the pleasant, enthusiastic librarian can show them how to find information, how to use the basic tools of research. They listen to her and look at one another and whisper in Spanish and French. But when she asks if they have any questions, they stare, embarrassing the librarian who wants to be helpful. I try to explain the simple idea of research. First, you choose a topic. What's that? Think of something you're interested in, maybe a problem bothering you and people in general. You could write about capitalism, religion, abortion, children, politics, education. Some of you come from Haiti or Cuba, two rich subjects. You could write about voodoo or the Bay of Pigs. You could look at some aspect of your country, human rights, for instance, do a little research, look at the pros and cons, think about it, come to a conclusion. "Excuse me, Professor, what's pros and cons?" "Pro is for, con is against." "Oh." The O means they have no notion of what I'm talking about. I have to backtrack, come at it from another angle. I ask them where they stand on capital punishment, The looks tell me they don't know where they stand because they don't know what I'm talking about. Capital punishment is